Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and what better way could there be to start off a week on this lovely Monday morning than to have with us in the studios Kate Jerome, who is an instructor in the horticulture department here at Gateway Technical College and director of Gateway's Urban Farm. And Kate is here to talk about a whole lot of different things, including Gateway's Urban Farm, what it's about, what its mission is, what it has already accomplished. We'll be talking about Gateway's upcoming plant sale this Saturday and an array of summer classes that Gateway is about to offer. And, of course, there will be time for some questions from you about your lawn or garden. We're going to kind of get rolling, and we'll give the phone number in just a couple of minutes and invite you, if you like, to give us a call here at WGTD or send an email to me directly, gberg@carthage.edu. You can do that anytime, gberg, G-B-E-R-G, at carthage.edu, if you have a question for Kate Jerome. And Kate, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here. So tell us what your impressions are of both the winter and the spring that we have. And of course, spring's officially not over by any means. In fact, in some ways, it feels like it hasn't yet started. But
the non-existent spring.
Yeah, right. Let's talk about winter, first of all. Way back when, what kind of a winter was it?
It was actually a milder winter than usual. We had probably close to average snowfall, maybe a little bit less. But we had warmer temperatures, which made it a little bit more tolerable. We were still well below freezing, we went below zero a couple of times. And so the bug kill, which is what we want in the wintertime, did happen. So we shouldn't have serious issues that we wouldn't normally have this year with pests.
So if we have too mild a winter, one of the prices we pay is that we have more bugs in the spring.
Right, right. The ones that normally die off in the winter don't die, and then you have higher populations.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that an avid gardener hopes for in terms of spring, and to what extent have we received that this spring?
Well, we've in our area, even though the Milwaukee Weather Channel says that we're below our rainfall needs, we're at our rainfall needs, if not more so in our area. We've gotten more rain than Milwaukee, basically. So we're good with water. We had good snow melt. And other than that, the temperature has done its usual spiking and then dropping. It's been a long, cool spring, and that's, even though it's not as happy for us because we want those 70-degree days, it actually lets the plants slide into spring and into summer a little bit less stressed. So the cool weather, even though it's keeping things small yet, is a good thing because it means that when things explode, they're going to go crazy.
Hmm. Now, as we've made our way through this spring and this spiking has occurred of temperatures, I mean, it always feels in the moment like it's really strange, like we just had this really warm day and the tulips are starting to come up, and then a couple days later, it drops below freezing or maybe even snows, and it feels like it happened at least a couple of times this spring. Are those moments that don't do the kind of damage that we might assume they do?
They don't do as much damage as you would think. Plants respond to temperature, but they also respond to day length. So a plant is on its cycle to come out of dormancy almost regardless of temperature. So plants, daffodils, for example, the daffodils started opening and then the temperature dropped. But if you'll notice, when you go back out there, the daffodils were not damaged. They're perfectly capable of withstanding those colder temperatures. The only risks that we have are the fruit trees blooming, because if they start blooming and then we have a frost, then the blossoms can be killed, and then we don't have fruit. So that's our one risk. We have not seen that this year. They were not far enough along to burst into blossom when we had those warm days. They're just blooming now, and I think we're on a steady climb, so I doubt we're going to have damage this year, which is great news.
Okay, so we dodged the bullet.
We dodged the bullet, yep.
Very, very good. I want to talk about a couple of different things, and then we'll ease into kind of the tips for this time of year and field some questions that we hope people will be posing to you. It's a kind of a year-round busy time for the horticulture department. It's not like just because it's summer, you suddenly click into action. I mean, even in the dead of winter, you're teaching classes about horticulture. In what way does life change for you and your colleagues and your students when we get to spring and summer, to kind of the prime time of growing? Does what you do change a lot?
It changes because we move from indoors to outdoors. During the wintertime, we teach greenhouse classes, and we have our hydroponic systems going. So we're growing the whole time. We're getting those bedding plants and vegetable plants ready during the winter and spring. And now that spring is here, and we move outdoors, and we start doing our planting on campus, and we have our plant sales to empty our greenhouses, basically. So it does kick into gear for us, but it's also a little bit more relaxed time because you're not hurrying from building to building trying to stay warm. It's nice outside, and we have a great group of student workers that work the grounds for us, do our learning gardens and the urban farm, and so it's... everybody's in a better mood in the spring and summer, so that helps.
Tell us what you mean by the term learning gardens.
We have extensive gardens that are on the south end of campus, across from the library, if you're familiar with the campus. And we have these gardens are, there are five gardens there. There's a butterfly garden, a spring garden, a fall garden, a Wisconsin native garden, and a cottage garden. And these are, the themed gardens have different sorts of plants in them, and we use it as a teaching laboratory for our students, but it's also open to the public. And when we have events here on campus, many times we'll have students that will volunteer to do tours of the garden and show people around, see what the plants are. So it's a wonderful place for us to experiment. We do a lot of plant trials, that plants that are not on the market yet. We will put plant trials in our learning gardens, but we also have specific trial gardens near our horticulture facility as well.
So tell us exactly where those are, people want to pay a visit.
It's on the south side of campus, and if you come in the south entrance, there's parking right there, right in front of the gardens. The doors into campus come, the one that's on the southeast side, goes right into the library, goes right past the library. You can't miss them. The magnolias are in full bloom right now, right along 30th Avenue. So anytime you want to come over and wander through, you're welcome to.
Speaking of events, I know that coming up this Saturday is the big blowout plant sale. Is this kind of a one-time event?
Actually, we have two this year. We have the one that's occurring this Saturday from 9 to 2, and then we'll have another one on June 4th. And the one on June 4th we will be doing in conjunction with an organization called the Wild Ones, so they will be specializing in native plants. But we'll have our bedding plants and shrubs and perennials. So we have the two big plant sales, but we also will be selling through the season with our farm stand. We sell produce, but we also will be selling plants as well. So you have a lot of chances to purchase.
So tell us, for instance, what is on sale on Saturday, where these plants have come from, sort of the circumstances under which they have been grown?
Well, the students do the growing. That's part of our program. They learn how to produce these plants, how to produce really spectacular specimens. And we've been growing annuals, perennials, vegetable plants, herbs. We have some baskets, containers, a little bit of everything. And the students are very proud of their work. This is also the major fundraising project for our horticulture club, Alpha Beta Hortus. And so the students in the club actually run the sale, and they do all the planning and the marketing and everything ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. So these plants are at what stage? I mean, are these like what you would find if you went to Stein's or Milliger's or some garden center?
Yep, just like a garden center, except that we don't grow the things that you find in big box stores or the common plants. We grow things that are a little bit different. That we want that reputation that we grow things that you can't find elsewhere. But the plants are of good size. They're ready to start hardening off and get them out into the garden. And hopefully it's time to do that.
Great. So give us some sense of what you mean by things that are a little more out of the ordinary. I mean, are they, generally speaking, the types of plants people look for, but just different varieties?
Or? In many cases, yes. We'll have petunias that other people have, but ours may be a little bit different color or a little bit different habit, maybe. You know, maybe a trailing petunias that you don't find elsewhere. And we stay ahead of the market. I mean, we stay on top of what the newest plants are, and so we like to bring in the newest ones. We will have some that other stores have. I mean, Milliger's and Stein also will have some of the same plants, but we don't grow a whole bunch of geraniums, for example, because you can get geraniums anywhere. And so we grow things that are a little bit different, a little bit out of the ordinary, to help enhance your garden.
Absolutely. We're talking with Kate Jerome, who is on the faculty of the Horticulture Department here at Gateway Technical College, also director of Gateway's Urban Farm, which we're going to be talking about next. We'll also outline a few classes that are being offered through Gateway's Horticulture program this summer. And we're going to get to some listener questions before we're done as well. So we've got lots to talk about. Kate, I thought it would be interesting to find out about just sort of the overall curriculum for Gateway's Horticulture program and talk about some of these summer classes. First of all, when somebody comes to Gateway to study horticulture, is it for a very specific degree that they're working, or is it kind of a flexible sort of program which can have a more than one outcome?
We have a very flexible program. We have two specific areas of focus that if you want to just come in and motor straight for that degree, you can go the greenhouse and marketing route, or you can go the landscape and design route. A lot of the classes overlap, so most of our students come out, they will take the few extra classes for one or the other, and they will come out with both areas of focus, which makes them fairly well-rounded. We have several certificates, one being our urban farming certificate, and we have, so you can come in and do the regular degree route. I would say 75% of our students are part-time students, and we have age range from 19 to 75.
Wow.
So there are people that are coming back for retraining, people that are coming back for lifelong learning. So there's different manner of ways that you can access the program. You can come take one course. You can come take a certificate, which is usually four courses. It's up to you. And we like to work with you so that you come out with a good experience.
How many students are studying horticulture with no serious aspirations to get a job in the field, who are studying it because they're really serious gardeners, but purely for their own pleasure? Or does that not happen very often?
It does happen. I would say not more than maybe 15% of our students. Most of them have a job in their head, or they're looking for something in the field. It may not be necessarily a career, but many of them are looking just to stay in the industry one way or another.
Right. So I can think of several different people I know who do something for a living, but on the side take tremendous pleasure in part-time work in this field. And I can think of at least one teacher who, when the school year is over, then devotes a fair amount of time to a part-time work in this field. So I suppose it offers that up for a lot of people as well.
It does. It lets you get your hands in the dirt. It lets you just go that further step than just gardening in your own backyard.
Mm-hmm. What kind of a field are we looking at right now? It seems like a field that is, for the most part, flourishing in terms of job opportunities.
For every student we graduate, there are probably 10 jobs waiting. It is amazing what is out there. And so the students can be very choosy about what they want. Wages are high. It's great for us right now.
Wow. So tell us what the array of classes are that are going to be offered in this upcoming summer term.
This summer we're offering two plant identification courses. One is herbaceous plants, which is all the annuals, perennials, everything that dies back to the ground, basically. And then landscape plants one, which is the woody trees and shrubs, both identification and culture classes. We're offering a vegetables class, which is everything you ever want to know about vegetable gardening, which is always a fun class. We are offering a horticulture events class, which is an event planning class. These are This is part of one of our floral certificates, and so students will take floral one, and then they'll take the business of floriculture, and then they'll take horticulture events, so they learn event planning. And this year, our great event that we're going to do this summer is we're going to do a farm-to-table dinner, which I think is going to be great fun to do, to put together.
I don't know what that is.
It's a it's basically a fundraising opportunity, and you bring people in, and you serve them, a chef serves them from the farm. We will use the food, the produce from the farm. And so it's a very high-class, fun evening out, long tables under the lights in the evening. It's a wonderful, wonderful event. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
Cool.
And then I'm also teaching the business of urban farming, which is the last class in the urban farming certificate. So basically learning how to put a business plan together for a farm, for a small farm.
Very good. Well, that segues nicely into something very significant that we want to talk about, namely Gateway's Urban Farm. And, of course, first of all, the term is a little bit odd, although I think probably some of our listeners have at least a whiff of what we're talking about. What is an urban farm?
An urban farm is basically a small farm, garden, and it's a spot where you can grow produce, but you can not only feed your family, but you can make a living at it. And that's what we teach, is how you plan and plant an area, half an acre, quarter acre, whatever you have, plant it intensely, and then basically sell the produce, whether you go to market, whether you sell through a CSA, a community-supported agriculture, by selling shares, sell to restaurants. There are a lot of different ways to do this, but it's teaching people to be sustainable in your own small environment, but also to be able to make a living at doing it instead of just feeding your family, which is that's pretty significant in itself. But to be able to add some income to that makes it a little bit more appealing.
Right. So the term is not so much that it must be in an urban area, although most of the time it typically would be, but when somebody is living in an urban area, if you're going to have some kind of garden, chances are it's going to be relatively compact versus the typical farm that we find out in the country where space is no object.
Right.
And all kinds of choices are available to you. When somebody is interested in doing this kind of farming in seriously confined space, then it becomes a really different enterprise.
Very different enterprise. You have to plan very carefully. You have to plant and grow in different methods because you're constantly making sure that there's no area of ground that is bare. So you always have crops ready to go in when something comes out. So it takes more work to do the planning, but the results are amazing, absolutely amazing.
So how long has Gateway had its own urban farm?
We've had a vegetable garden for a lot of years, and the urban farm has actually been in production probably for, I think this may be our sixth year, and it's expanded every year. So now we're at full tilt right now, and it's I'm constantly amazed at what we can do in our small area.
Hmm. So where is the urban farm located?
It's right next to the horticulture facility, the Pike Creek Horticulture Center. We have the main farm down right next to the building, and then up the hill near the Center for Sustainable Living is a second part of the farm. So we grow different things in the different parts of the farm according to the conditions that we have. And we are producing enough produce now that we have our urban farm market every Thursday. Our big kickoff is this coming Thursday, which is actually Cinco de Mayo, May 5th. We're open the doors at 1 o'clock, and we're there till 6, so we're hoping to catch people after work as well. But the urban farm market that's where our produce goes. We sell to the public. We used to sell just to faculty and staff. We now have opened it up completely to the public. We will also be donating any extra produce probably to food shelters. We also are looking at possibly starting a student food bank. So that's another possibility. It's still in the planning stages, but it's something we'd like to do. But at our farm stand, we have I don't want to call it a farm stand. It's a farm market. Mm. We'll have, of course, produce from the farm, but we also have local honey. We have free-range eggs. We're growing mushrooms. We have fresh and dried herbs of every possible variety. And we eventually will start having salsas and pickles and that sort of thing as well.
Wow. So talk for a moment about the intense and complicated planning that you were touching on earlier that is really essential to an urban farm being successful when it comes to very carefully mapping out what will be planted and when. I mean, just give us some insight on how that's done.
Well, basically, you have to map your farm so that you know exactly how much space you have, and you're going to be planting three seasons. So you do a spring, summer, and fall plan. And the spring plan, of course, that's your lettuce and spinach and those things that grow in the cool season. But the intensive methods that are used, first of all, the plants are closer together than they would be in a conventional farm, so that you have the plants literally touch each other just barely touch when they're full grown. So they create a living mulch, which reduces your weeding. But one of the keys of this system working well, because you're planting so much closer together, is you have to have good soil prep. The soil has to be prepared very well before you start.
Are you saying because, in a sense, the soil is being taxed more than under conventional circumstances?
It's being taxed more, but also because you're planting closer together, you want those roots to go down. You want them to be able to go down as far as they can instead of spreading out, so there's less competition between plants. But yes, the soil is taxed, so one of the key parts of an intensive system is that you constantly are putting back into the soil. As soon as you harvest, something goes, you know, you're adding compost, you have mulch there all the time. So the soil is a living organism. It's the most important living organism on the farm. Regardless of the produce, if your soil is not good, if it's not healthy and thriving with all those little microorganisms, you're not going to have success.
Right. And are you talking in terms of that's interesting about the roots needing to go down versus out. In terms of prepping the soil, are you just talking about sort of its density, that it needs to be not too dense so it can go down, or are there other things that draw the roots down?
It's not necessary. It's not so much the density. The key is having organic matter, having deep organic matter, a lot of it. So you constantly add organic matter. The soil...
And the roots seek that out then.
Right, and it allows water to infiltrate. It holds on to water for this plant, and part of it is loosening up the soil, making sure it's nice and loose. One of the principles of doing a brand new farm is what they call double digging, where you basically dig out a shovel full of soil and then you go down below that and dig out the second shovel and then put it back in, so you've loosened it almost 2 feet down.
Wow.
It's a lot of work, but it makes a huge difference in your production.
How much of a risk is it in the sense of Mother Nature's vagaries? I mean, that things don't always proceed according to plan. So in a sense, is an urban farm always sort of teetering on the brink because things might take longer to grow or not grow at all, with dry spells or wet spells or whatever, or not particularly if you've planned well?
Well, part of it is planning well, but also Mother Nature's always going to get you in the end. That's just part of it. But if with an urban farm, you're growing a wide variety of plants, so that if you have a crop failure with one type of plant, you've got others that are filling in. Whereas on a conventional farm, if you're doing monocropping, if something happens to your corn, you're done. There's nothing that can, nothing to take the place of that corn that was eaten or whatever happened to it. So on an urban farm, you have a lot of variety. There are methods where you can actually move into a permaculture system, which is basically setting up an ecological balanced system. And Mother Nature may throw her hits at it, but she can't take it down in the end.
If we... I assume that in terms of trying to keep pests away, that Gateway tries to do things in the most ecologically sensitive ways possible.
Yes, we grow, everything is grown organically, including our greenhouses. We use only biological controls in our greenhouses, so there's no chemical pest control. But we have a lot of things in our arsenal, and one of the things that we just, I mean, when you talk about pests, you talk about bugs, but also weeds are pests as well. One of the tools that we just purchased that I can hardly wait to use this year is a steam weeder. It's a like a canister, a vacuum canister, and you fill it with water, and it heats the water, and then it has a little pitchfork that you basically stick in the weed, and you give it a shot of steam, and it kills the weed.
Wow!
So I'm really looking forward to trying this out. We also have a flame weeder, which we call our Dragon, which has a propane tank, and which is not very sustainable, but you just pass over the weed with this flame, and it kills the weed as well. So that's two mechanical methods for controlling weeds. But otherwise, we rely on beneficial insects. Whenever you plant an intense garden, one of the parts that you put in that garden are plants that will draw beneficial insects in so that they basically take care of your pests. Mm. You know, this nature will do it for you, but you have to sometimes encourage it a bit.
Right. For those of you just joining us, we have in the studios today Kate Jerome from the Horticulture Department here at Gateway Technical College, and she is here to field any questions that you might have. We're going to move into that right now. Though, Kate, let's restate before we go on to all that, the Urban Farm Stand, which kicks off this Thursday.
Right, this Thursday is our big kickoff party. There's going to be music and kids' activities and all kinds of things going on, plus good produce to purchase, and eggs and honey. The farm market will be open from 1 to 6 right on the Gateway campus. So you just come in one of the two north entrances, head back toward the horticulture building, and you'll be able to see it right there.
Very good. If you have a question for Kate Jerome, you are welcome to give us a phone call here at WGTD at 262-564-8450. 564-8450. You're also welcome to send me an email directly, gberg@carthage.edu, gberg@carthage.edu, and I'll be happy to pass on your question to Kate Jerome, and we will get things rolling. Kate, here's the first question, which actually came to me via a Facebook friend. This is from Alyssa. What are the easiest, lowest maintenance vegetables and or herbs to grow on a small balcony? She lives in a condo and does not have a yard, and she does have some partial shade. Any ideas?
Something small. If you want to stay with small varieties, you can actually, it's hard to say without knowing exactly how much sun you have, but there are container varieties of almost all types of plants. You can grow cherry tomatoes on a balcony in a container very easily. Hmm. But I would stay with the smaller plants. Do lettuce and spinach, of course. You could grow cucumbers if you wanted to try. Small peppers work very well in containers. They do need full sun. So if you have only half a day of sun, you're going to have to stay more with the greens type of plants. There are a lot of herbs that will thrive in containers. You can grow any of the herbs, basil, chives, sage, just about anything. The perennial herbs like sage and oregano will not go through the winter in a pot, so you just have to treat them as an annual plant. But you can buy them just about anywhere. And our farm stand and our plant sale, we have small potted herbs, and you just pop them into a container, and then you'll have wonderful food on your balcony all summer.
Wow. And by the way, does the type of container matter very much in terms of size and even what it's made of?
It doesn't matter what it's made of. The most important feature is that it has some drainage. You don't want it having a solid bottom on it, so it needs to drain well. And the larger the plant, the larger the container, the more root space you're going to need. If you're going to grow carrots, you need something that's going to be at least 6 to 8 inches deep. That's just a logical thing. If you're going to grow radishes, you can grow them in a saucer, basically. Hmm. So just think about the size of the vegetable, what the root system's going to look like, and then plan accordingly with your container.
Very good. Another question that has come into us, and again, you can call in your question to 564-8450, area code 262-564-8450, or an email to gberg@carthage.edu. Here is a question from Patty. My square foot beds are established and I used a growing medium of peat moss, compost, and vermiculite. I intend to add some of the wonderful contents of my vermicompost bin, mm-hmm. of which she provided the worms. So this is a story you're going to have to share with us.
Okay.
We installed a wood stove this past year. I have heard that the ashes can be a great addition to one's garden. Is that true? And if so, should I limit the amount? So let's talk about the specific question first, and then we'll get the backstory.
Okay, I never recommend using wood ash in your garden. If you live in the East and you're using and you have regular garden soil, then it's fine. But wood ash tends to make soil; it tends to raise the pH, and the soil in your square foot garden isn't really soil because you don't have any garden soil in there. And adding something like wood ash can take things kind of, it can skew the nutrients that are in there. So I think I would suggest not doing it. If you have a way of disposing of it in a compost, then that's a better way to take care of it. It's wood ash is, unfortunately, is one of those waste products that's hard to get rid of. And it's because of our soil, it's not a good idea to spread it on the soil if you can avoid it. So
Because of what?
It raises the pH in garden soil.
And you're saying specifically like in this part of the country?
This part of the country. We have high pH soil anyway. In the East, they have low pH soil. So adding something that is going to raise it a bit is not an issue there and can actually help. Here, you can take the pH high enough that it starts damaging plants.
I see. So she...
Soil chemistry, basically.
Right, right. So she most likely heard that advice maybe from somebody in another part of the country
exactly.
talking about the benefits of that. So
right.
It's a no-no here in Wisconsin, for
right.
the most part at least.
Right.
Can you just say a quick word about all these big words that I scarcely understand, like vermiculite and vermicompost? I know what worms are, but...
vermiculite and vermicompost are actually not connected. Vermiculite is a volcanic product there that is basically heat expanded, and it's added to commercial potting mixes to retain moisture.
Mm.
That's what that is. So it's not soil at all.
Mm-hmm.
Vermicomposting, verma means worm. And I don't know why vermiculite has verma in it. I'll have to do some research on that. But vermicomposting is composting with worms. And it is an indoor process most of the time. Some people do it outside as well. But it is a system, it's a closed system where you purchase a specific kind of worm called a red wiggler. And you put them in this bin, and then you provide the organic matter for them to eat, and they turn the organic matter, vegetable scraps, that sort of thing, and paper, into compost. And then you can use that in your gardening. And it's very rich, richer than regular compost, and it's very concentrated, and it's an absolutely wonderful, wonderful product. We do vermicomposting on the campus, and I periodically give away worms because we have enough worms to share.
Mm.
So I do like to give them away and get people started on vermicomposting.
Wow, sounds like something quite spectacular. Is that something that needs to be used with some kind of restraint? Is it possible to use too much of that? Is it too much of a good thing or not?
It could be too much of a good thing, but the worms don't make that much. So getting too much of it is going to be a hard thing to do initially. But yes, it's because it's rich. If you use too much, you certainly could. It could be detrimental to your soil.
If you have a question for Kate Jerome, feel free to give us a phone call here at WGTD at 564-8450 or send an email, gberg@carthage.edu, and we'll be happy to share your question with Kate Jerome. We have a couple more questions, one that has just come in. Kate, can you say a word about soil tests? I'm not sure where this person is writing from, but they are curious about whether or not this is something that an ordinary homeowner should think about having done? And if so, how would they have a soil test done?
Soil test is a good idea, especially in a new garden. It will give you an idea of what your soil makeup is, and it also, they'll give you recommendations as to what you can add to it, because they, when you do the soil test, they ask you what you're going to be growing there. So the state will make recommendations as to what you can add to your soil to make it better. Basically, a soil test is you gather a cup of soil from like four or five different spots in the garden, the area that you plant, that you intend to plant. And then you send it off to the state lab. It costs, I'm not sure what it costs this year. It used to cost $15. It may be up to $18 or $20 now. And the county extension office that's out on Highway 50 and 45 you just take your little Ziploc bag of soil out there, and they have all the paperwork to fill out to send the soil test in. So they'll send it to the state lab, and then when it comes back, it will tell you about your soil and give you recommendations on how to improve it.
So typically, what does a soil test result look like? I mean, is it a bunch of numbers, or
it's numbers, but the numbers are interpreted for you because they're assuming that nobody knows what, you know, 4.5 on the pH scale means without some interpretation.
Right.
So it will tell you the nutrients that are in your soil, your nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, and then it will also tell you what your pH is, and it will tell you the amount of organic matter you have in your soil. And with each one of those, it will have an explanation and a recommendation as to whether you need to improve it or change it and how to do that.
Very good.
So it's a lot of good information. This time of year, it's always very busy, the state lab, so springtime, you're going to have to wait a little bit longer to get your results. The best time to test your soil is in the fall, because then it goes right in and you know what's going on.
Very good. We're taking questions for Kate Jerome at gberg@carthage.edu, or feel free to give us a phone call, 564-8450. Don't be shy. We'd love to have you go right on the air with Kate Jerome to ask your question. Kate, a question has just come in that's kind of intriguing. I'm not sure that Kate is a tree person, but I'm wondering if she has any recommendations for what would be a good replacement for two lovely ash trees that I recently lost.
Oh, boy, this your heart.
Yeah. Well, in this, I not too long ago drove through Petrifying Springs. My father-in-law had told me about, and I'd heard also of the decimation there, the hundreds of trees that had to come down, but I hadn't actually seen it for myself. And I drove through and saw all those forlorn-looking stumps, and it was just, yeah.
It looks like a war zone.
Yeah.
It's really sad.
Yeah.
But we'll recover from this. We will recover. I actually am a tree person. That's my specialty.
Oh, okay.
Even though I like vegetables better than trees.
Yeah, I guess that's what we don't talk about trees as much. So.
Right. A couple of good recommendations that favorites of mine, one of them is a swamp white oak, which is it's a white oak. It's a fairly fast-growing oak, because we think of oaks as being very slow-growing, but the swamp white oak is fairly fast-growing compared to some of the others, and it's extremely tolerant of bad situations. Regular white oak has a serious problem with disturbance. It doesn't transplant well. It has all kinds of issues. They're beautiful plants, but they're not really suited to the urban landscape. The swamp white oak has all the good traits that the regular white oak does not. So it's a really good plant. Another plant that I happen to really love, and it may be overplanted now, but I still think it's a wonderful plant, is the Freeman maple. It's has the best traits of the silver and the red, and not the ugly traits of the silver maple that we don't like. The Freeman has a really nice red fall color, and it's a nice shape. Great shade tree, so a really nice replacement tree.
So those are two good ideas then.
Yeah, definitely.
Very good. My understanding is that some of the places that have lost their ash, one of the things they're trying to do is diversify whatever the new tree population is.
That's critical. That's the problem with any kind of monoculture. Once something comes in, it takes it all down, and so it's really important. That's what happened with the American elm years ago.
Oh, yeah. We're old enough to remember that, yeah.
And just decimated the whole population. So it's really important that even in your own yard that you don't plant a lot of the same thing, that you have the diversity, because it brings in a variety of wildlife and it's healthier in the long run.
And here is a question from email, but sort of springs out of something that Patrick saw from Racine saw on Facebook. I recently saw on Facebook something about how the first dandelions that appear in one's garden provide tremendously important food for bees and thus should be allowed to grow. Do you agree?
I agree completely. And the greens of the first dandelions, you can harvest the greens for yourself because they are so full of vitamins that if you can tolerate a little bit of bitterness, as the season goes on, they get more bitter, but the early ones are not quite as bitter. But just grab a handful of those and chop them up in your salad, and it will give you a huge vitamin boost.
Ah.
But the first dandelion flowers, yes, they're so – this plant has stored all this energy from the fall before, and then they hang on to it, and then it just kind of bursts out of the plant. So there's a lot of a really good pollen and nectar that helps feed the bees.
So that's why the first, the, I mean, the, 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 uh, the question refers to the first dandelions.
The first flush, right.
And so those are especially nutritious, and those are absolutely the ones you should leave alone.
Leave alone and not start the weed control.
Right. Interesting. We'll ask one last time if anyone has a question for Kate Jerome. We've had some good questions thus far. Email address gberg@carthage.edu. Otherwise, a phone call is welcome to 564-8450, 564-8450. You can put yourself at the disposal of Kate Jerome, who knows just everything there is to know about lawn and garden and trees, she's just told us. So very, very good. Kate, I know that we are in the time of year when it is time for certain house plants that can be outside to be moved outside, and we'll get to that in a second. But first, I think we have a caller. Caller, go ahead. You're on the air with Kate Jerome. Whoops. Let's try that again. Caller, you're on the air with Kate Jerome.
Yes. I have two mature Colorado blue spruce in my yard in the back, and one of them has begun to die off over the last 6 or 7 years. From the bottom up, the bottom branches have slowly turned brown, and I've removed some of them up to as tall as I can stand. And the other one on the other side of the yard is pretty healthy, but it started to show some browning as well. I'm wondering, is this something that's contagious with these spruce trees, or is it just old age? They were probably planted in the early 80s, 1982, round in there. And, I just hate to see this one dying. The top of it, the top half is still pretty healthy, but the bottom half is dying off.
Unfortunately, that's what happens to Colorado spruce. If you look at, if just in driving around town, you'll notice that the lower branches do die off on spruce over time. It's not just old age. There is a disease that gets in. It's called Cytospora canker. I can't even say it right. It's a fungal disease that does take those lower branches. There's nothing you can do to stop it. It spreads, but it doesn't spread. It's just always there, I guess, is the only thing I can say. So it's something that with Colorado spruce you just have to live with. Same in my yard. I have some old ones and I have some young ones that are great. The old ones are all losing their lower branches, and I just keep pruning them up as best I can. There's nothing really that you can do to stop it, and the one that's fairly healthy, it will start declining the same way. Their lifespan is usually about 35 to 40 years. And so once they start this decline, you just have to accept it. Plant a new little one beside it. So
I have. I planted two smaller ones, and they're about 5 feet tall now. We started them from little seedlings, and now they're very healthy. But I was wondering, I was worried about those as well, if they would get this, if it was a contagious fungal disease or something.
But probably not until they're much older. They'll start doing the same thing. But I would advise, make sure that, especially if we end up in a drought time when it's really dry, make sure you water them. I mean, you don't often think of watering your spruce, but just make sure that, because that keeps them from stress. And the longer they're not stressed, the longer they'll fend it off.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
Appreciate the call. The phone number, 564-8450, although time is dwindling. If someone called really quickly, we could probably sneak the question in and would be very, very happy to do so. 564-8450. Oops, and there is that call. Go ahead. You're on the air with Kate Jerome.
Hi. I heard you speaking about the mechanical weed control with the steam that you're going to be trying. Do you think you could do some sort of a study on how well it works on teasel?
That's a good idea. We don't have teasel here. We haven't had the problem with that, although there may be some areas I'm just thinking that I haven't checked out to see if we have it.
And can you translate what that
Teasel is? It's a noxious weed. It's an imported weed, and it looks like a thistle. It looks almost like a thistle. And teasel is really awful.
It's nasty.
It is.
It's got thorns under the leaves, on the stems, on the leaves, on the flower heads, everywhere.
Yeah, it is really.
It's like a super villain.
You can eat it. When it's really young, you can eat it, but I can't imagine wanting to.
And I have yet to be able to eradicate it. It started in my area. I'm in Pleasant Prairie, and everywhere I look, I see it now.
Yeah, it is. It is spreading. I live in Pleasant Prairie, too, and it's spreading like crazy throughout the whole village.
Oh, dear.
That's something it might be worth us trying. I'd have to find a nice spot that we could manage that, wouldn't be touched by anything else to do the study on it. But
sure. My place.
I got to get it after my bindweed here on the farm first. That's our biggest issue.
I think I'd take your bindweed over this nasty
over the teasel. Yeah, yeah.
I've even tried digging it, and every time I try to eradicate it in any way, it comes back stronger.
Right. Anytime you dig it, you're separating it one plant into two. So.
Wow. Sounds nasty.
I'll start doing some research and just see if there's been any studies done on this. There's not a lot of information out about this steam weeding, so it's going to be an experiment all the way along.
Yes. Also, you talked about the pH. Now, I'm in Pleasant Prairie, and my soil is as neutral can be.
Uh-huh. So
when you say it raises the pH, does that mean acidify it?
No, it means it alkalinizes it.
Oh.
It makes it more alkaline. Yeah, makes it more alkaline.
Okay. Because I can't get any more neutral than 7.2.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect for most plants.
So keep doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you very much.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
The call. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, good to end the hour with a couple of phone calls and a couple of interesting questions. I'd never heard of teasel before, and it sounds like it's nothing you want to encounter. So hopefully you're...
The only use for teasel is to cut it and dry it and spray it gold for Christmas.
Okay. Well, we'll hope that maybe the technology of steam is going to bring it down. Real quick, Kate, let's sail our way through your list of tips for this time of year. Houseplants need to start coming outdoors, but only gradually.
Right. If you want to bring some houseplants out, make sure that the temperatures stay. Don't bring them out until the temperature is above 45 degrees consistently at night. And do it gradually so that they don't get sunburned.
What about this matter of hardening off flower and vegetable plants?
It's the same process. Whenever you purchase flower or vegetable plants from a garden center or from us, ours are hardened off, but not all garden centers have theirs. They bring them right out of the greenhouse, and they haven't been exposed to the outside weather. So you need to make sure, or if you're growing your own in your basement even, make sure that you gradually expose them to the outside weather before you put them in the garden where they can't fend for themselves.
You remind us to water anything we've planted this spring, but to not water too much.
Right. I have constant comments from people, my tree is dying. I planted it this spring. It's dying. I water it every day. It's dying. Well, you're not supposed to water every day. A long, deep watering once a week is what it needs.
So people are drowning their plants,
their
not
plants.
Realizing that they are. So
right.
Looks like it's time to thin fruits on the fruit trees.
As your fruits start producing fruit, apple trees, peach trees, whatever type of fruits, you want to make sure you go in when the fruits are about a quarter inch, maybe half inch size. You want to go in and pinch out all in a cluster except one fruit. It hurts to do it, but it makes for one healthy fruit, and it will. Otherwise, there's too much competition, and you get smaller fruits all the way around.
You have an interesting tip here, transplant on cloudy days. What is it about cloudy days?
It's less stress on a plant. More pure and simple, you transplant on a sunny day. There's a lot of sun beating down on those tender plants. So if you can transplant on a cloudy day, it lets them settle in for a little bit before they get hit with the sun.
And last but not least, a quick word about coffee grounds.
Save your coffee grounds. Use them for mulch. Make coffee tea. That sounds kind of odd, but soak them in water and use them as a liquid fertilizer. Add them to your compost. Excellent, excellent organic matter.
Interesting. Well, this has been an interesting hour, as always, with Kate Jerome, who is with the horticulture program here at Gateway Technical College. We want to remind you that the farm stand from Gateway's Urban Garden kicks off this Thursday from 1 to 6.
One to six, right.